Good afternoon, Seven Investors, and welcome to the Wednesday edition of Seven Investing Now. My name, of course, is Daniel Brooks Klein. I'm the host of the program. I'm being joined today from Australia by Anirban Mahanty. We're going to talk about whether anything could slow Tesla down, as well as the upcoming Rivian IPO. Anirban, I noticed there is light behind you today. So you have sort of the opposite of daylight savings, right? Like, we're actually going to be 2 hours closer in terms of time when we hit our daylight savings, which is soon. I'm not entirely sure when it is, yes. But so it's 7 a.m. there?
Right now? It's right now 7:40, but yeah. I like to think about 4 p.m. Eastern, which is when the market in the U.S. closes. And I go from being 6 o'clock at some point in time, like in the middle of the night or middle of winter, to sort of in summer, it becomes 8. For me, when it's my summer, which is your winter, it becomes 8 a.m. So, I have a 4 hour, like a stretch, 2 hour stretch window there from,
I fully understand the stress. But first of all, we don't have winter. I live in Florida. We have summer and super duper summer. We're just leaving super duper summer, heading into regular summer where it's only like 88 degrees outside now. I used to work for a West Coast based team for Microsoft. And it was super stressful because like I worked market hours, like I was covering the stock market. So I started like 6:30 and got off at like 4 or somewhere around there, handed off to a West Coast guy who had a really easy job. He's a good friend, so I can say that. But then I'd have like meetings at 7 o'clock at night, or my boss was still working at like 8, my time, because that was 5 his time. That was very stressful. But let's get to it with Tesla here. So what I wanted to talk about here is Tesla reported some good numbers, but we know you own Tesla. We know you drive a Tesla. I want to talk about, you have a Tesla cup, which is rare as well. Did you have the Tesla bot? Is that a Tesla shirt as well?
This is a Tesla Cybertruck t-shirt, or this is a Tesla plaid t-shirt, one of those.
Do you have the flamethrower or the limited edition boxer shorts? Do you have either of those?
No. So, the boxer shorts were out. Or the short shorts, as they call it, and they were out, so I couldn't get them. And the flamethrower, they were not sending outside the U.S. How rude of them.
Well, I now know what I'm getting a Anirban for Australian Christmas, which I think happens the same time as our Christmas. Tesla delivered 241,300 electric vehicles during the third quarter of 2021. They delivered no gas vehicles because they don't make any. So it's weird that they say electric vehicles, but they do. That is slightly ahead of analyst expectations, which mean nothing. I could care less about analyst expectations. They produced slightly less than that, 237,823 cars. How are they getting around the chip shortage? Like, it feels like Ford made 46 cars and Tesla hit all its numbers. That's not true, and we're going to get to it later. But how are they getting around the chip shortage?
So, again, I think Tesla is a very agile company. So the shortage, if you think about it, is really in for the basic stuff, right? So the shortage is in finding the chip for your airbag. The shortage is for, finding the chip that goes into your, maybe your, brake fluid levels or something like that. It's a lot of the basic cheap stuff, really cheap stuff, low end, integrated circuits that are really, hard to find. And Tesla being, a newer company, more advanced technology, uses a lot of newer chips. That's one. So, it's probably paying a premium price on those newer tech, right? So it would be in the front of the queue in terms of getting things. So that's part of it. The other part is in last earnings call, Musk explained this and he said that, look, we changed the chip when we found an alternative chip, we changed the firmware that was necessary to make the the boards work. So we changed the firmware. So we changed the software. The firmware is basically, you think of that as software. They changed the software and the hardware when necessary to just work around with what was available. So just more agile. And of course, I would also say that their volumes are high, but not as high as some of the other ones. But it's something a combination of factors.
Well, we've seen, and I can appreciate this having run a factory, obviously nowhere near a Tesla factory, but if I got a big order, I would like borrow equipment and set up in the yard or like an empty space and we'd make what we had to make. Tesla has famously done that with its tents. Is this just the agility and the hunger of being a young company?
I think so. Like, so this is, the older a company gets, the more set in its ways. Now, this is not always true, this is generalization, but they get, you know, it's like us as human beings, right? The older we get, you know, I have a set routine. I need my coffee at a certain time. And if I don't get my coffee at a certain time, I mean, you'd appreciate this, Dan, I can get cranky, right? Whereas, you know, the younger person might be, you know, like if they're the young Max, he's more adaptive.
I think that's not true. I think Max is a bad millennial. And I will point out that having been tied to a news cycle for the vast majority of my life, career-wise, I'm actually pretty adaptable for an old guy, because when your job, again, probably half my working life has been like, wait a minute, this happened at 9 o'clock at night. And we see it now at Seven Investing. And I think this is relevant to Tesla because it's part of being a young company. Because I agree, when I worked at Microsoft, they weren't great at adapting to something being different. Whereas at Tesla, it's part of the romance. Like, it's part of the fun of being in a startup. And for me, it's always been part of the news business. And we do it at Seven Investing. Something happens and we're all on Slack at like 11 o'clock at night chatting about it. And I'm figuring out how to make that content the next day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think it's a combination of things. Again, Tesla is just a very agile company. It's very fast moving, which, you know, they change things. And, you know, so another way to think about this is if you look at the Model 3, I got my Model 3 in 2019. Between 2019 and 2021, it's only been 2 years. A lot of stuff has changed in the Model 3. Outward, it looks the same, but you know, if you just think about the smaller things, the details, there's continuous refinement going on. It's just always moving. So yeah, I think part of that, you know, it's a combination of things. Volume is of course less than traditional auto, but it's getting there. It's getting there in terms of volume now. So
well, let's talk about that, because you know the volume, and I'll remind you, Tesla delivered 241,000 and change vehicles in the quarter. My next question is, how does this compare to how the traditional automakers are doing? But I'll share some of those numbers. General Motors delivered 446,000, almost 447,000 vehicles in the US in the third quarter. That's down by 218,000. Ford, down about a third in July and August, only about 18% in September. So Tesla's numbers are up and they're getting closer to the big boys, right?
Yeah, so as you read, right? So the numbers that we are quoting there are US numbers, whereas Tesla's numbers are worldwide. So that there's that difference there. But yeah, like, I mean, if you just, you could just assume the Tesla's numbers roughly about maybe 60% of them is roughly US or Canada. I think that's, you know, I think most of those numbers are North America for Ford and GM. But yeah, the numbers are getting up there. And I think the critical thing to think about is this: what's going to happen when Texas goes online? So when the Texas Gigafactory goes online, we yet don't know what the capacity of that is, but my bet would be it'll be somewhere in the million ballpark, right? Once that is online, Tesla might well be among the very big manufacturers, US-based manufacturers. Actually, when I say US-based, the company that's actually making the vehicles in the US might want to be, you know, the top two or top three easily at that point. So that's something very interesting to think about. A last point I'll make before I turn it back to you is, while, you know, you read the Ford, the GM numbers, right? The GM numbers for the US were down like roughly 50%, let's call it, give or take a bit. And Ford, you know, 30%, and then 18%, somewhere around, you know, maybe 25-30% down, right? I would bet the US numbers for Tesla are up probably 60-70%, because, you know, Tesla's sales volume is up almost 100% year over year. Of course, off a smaller base, but that's still phenomenal, right? I mean, you know, one company is growing really quickly, taking almost all the share in EVs, the others are not. So
I've asked this question before, but it baffles me. So I'll ask it again. The cheapest Tesla on a practical basis is in the $40,000. And that depends on tax rebates. There might be some people who are getting it a little cheaper, but most people are paying roughly $42,500 for the lowest end Tesla. That's really, really expensive for a car. I've never spent more than $11,000 on a car. I drive, you know, relatively low end cars. I have an older Toyota Prius at the moment. I had a Nissan Versa before that. I had a Hyundai Elantra. I had a Saturn. Like, I guess, so I'm not driving BMW. I had a BMW, but it was an older one. I had a Mini Cooper. It was an older one. I'm not driving nice cars, but if a Toyota Corolla is, you know, $299 a month, at some point, is there more market share for Tesla to take in the US at that? Like, it just feels like a very high price point, but I get that I am not a typical car buyer.
Yeah, so that's an interesting point, Dan, right? I mean, so I have been like you for essentially the entire life until I got a Tesla. So, you know, I've had a Toyota Tercel, you know, which is basically the smaller than the Echo or smaller than the Corolla. They don't make the Tercel anymore. Then I had
a Tercel at one point as Tercel. Well.
And it's a great car, really reliable car. I had over 200,000 kilometers on it or 20,000 kilometers when I got rid of it. Then I had a Hyundai Elantra, just like you. And I didn't buy a Toyota Corolla largely because the Elantra gave me everything with slightly worse acceleration and crappy engine noises, but it was very reliable. And I got that. We had a Toyota Corolla here in Australia. We have a Nissan Murano. So no, I'm typical, like many others, I don't spend high money, but that is, I think, a couple of things are working in Tesla. There is, of course, the new product, the new thing that drives people to upsize, right? Tesla has been stealing share from the luxury market, like the, you know, the BMW, the, you know, the upper end Camry. And the Tesla Model 3 is an interesting car because the Tesla Model 3 is larger than a Corolla. It's probably in the Camry because you think of the size overall, it's in that sort of the Camry space. It's not a small car, but it's not maybe a large vehicle either. And I think the Tesla Model S is also an odd vehicle. It somewhere sits between a BMW 5 and a 7 in terms of sizing and spacing and things like that. So the market is wide. And for its market, I think Tesla has priced its vehicles very intelligently. It's intelligent pricing. The question you're saying is, if Tesla went down market, what's going to happen, right? And I think that's the, you know, at this point in time, if we look at how the BEV transition, the battery electric vehicle transition is going for everybody else, if Tesla went downstream, gosh, I don't know how the others are going to actually have, you know, this is going to be survival issues for some of the other ones because Tesla's already got really good margins. It can actually juice, it can reduce the prices if it wanted to take more share versus, you know, take a lower margin, right? The margin is to some extent fungible. And there is talk that Tesla is going to make the Tesla Q, which I think they should call it the Tesla Q. I wish they have, you know, trademarked it. So that's the $25,000 vehicle that they're thinking about. And that is already on the roadmap. And apparently it's going to be made, it's being designed in Shanghai, out of their Shanghai factory. And it would be a real big hit. I think that vehicle probably is not a US vehicle, right? It probably is more suitable for the Asian market and the European market. You know, US has got big wide roads, at least in many parts, and so does Canada. Whereas the large parts of the world have narrower roads, you know, tighter parking spots and things like that, where this sort of vehicle would be really, really useful. But I think we've got some ways to go.
Well, to go down market in the US, wouldn't they also have to do it in a very noticeable protect the brand way? And I'll point out, like, BMW, which owns Mini Cooper, and everyone knows that they make the Mini Cooper, but they don't call it a BMW. Or if you buy a BMW 1 Series, there is a notable snobbiness at the dealer. Like, it's like you're staying in a junior suite. Like, it's not quite a suite. You don't get to access the suite lounge. Like I feel like to protect the snootiness of owning a Tesla, which there is plenty of that, and there certainly is with Peloton and other luxury brands, or even the Lululemon yoga pants would have that. They'd have to protect that, right?
Yeah, to some extent, yes. So I think the Tesla strategy there resembles a little like the Apple strategy, right? So they have a small range of products, and each product has a limited range of options. Right. So it's like, you know, it's like, you know, you want the iPhone Pro or you want the Pro Max. You can't get, like, you know, you can choose, I guess, how many terabytes of storage you want, but that's really it. Right. Tesla even doesn't even offer you that choice. And the same thing with the Model 3, right? I mean, you want to basically, Tesla Model 3 performance is no different from a Tesla Model 3 long range. One has just got faster acceleration. In fact, you can, after the fact, buy the acceleration if you want as a software upgrade. And the Tesla Model 3 long range is very similar to the Tesla Model 3 standard range plus, except that it just has a smaller battery. So I think the smaller battery and the smaller form factor just I think it's just a question of which vehicle appeals to which crowd, right? If you want a daily running around car, then you might be happy with a Tesla Q. If you want a car that goes long distance for your trips to the national parks, then you probably have a Model 3, right? And if you want to show off a car, then you get the Tesla Model S plate version, right? And you show off your acceleration. I think the other thing I'll point out in terms of pricing is that, you know, $299 versus $399, I think Tesla leases for around $399 in the US. I think it's like a $100 difference, but you know, you save a lot on servicing. Teslas really don't need any servicing, right? So if you factor in the cost, they're probably already at parity if you are thinking longer term. If you're thinking of the overall cost of running the vehicle, then if you factor in energy cost and if you factor in servicing cost, you're probably very close to parity. Actually, smaller Tesla would destroy the parity to the extent where it'll become almost nonsensical to have a ICE age vehicle.
I would go with the Tesla SE. If everything can be something plus, there is no reason why Tesla can't steal the Apple naming construct where you get the shameful low-end iPhone for your kid, the SE. Though my son is lucky because I get a new phone every year. He has, it's like a 10, or he has a good one, like because I forgot to return it and he needed a new phone. So that works out. But a couple more questions here. Then we're going to talk about Rivian, the upcoming IPO. And that actually leads into this question. Do you think that there's any company, be it an old line vehicle maker or an EV rival like Rivian or Lucid, that can compete, that can pose a risk for Tesla? Like, I would argue that, geez, the only automaker like I really like, not as an investment, but it's just a company, is Toyota, for all the reasons you just talked about. Like, the cars are really reliable. It's a car that, in my Prius, feels small, but it's actually big when it comes to storage. That was something I really liked about my tiny little Nissan as well. But can any of these companies become real rivals? You know, and I guess in the old school way, it's, can they survive in order to become a rival?
So that's a great question, Dan. You know, here's my way of thinking about this. So let's you know, the traditional, so if we backtrack a bit, the usual Tesla bear case is, well, Tesla can't manufacture, you know, look at those panel gaps. Well, Tesla just showing through the pandemic that it can not only manufacture, it is very adaptive and it can manufacture at pace and you guys can't keep up. Right? That's number one. Its factories are coming up at record speed time and they're very efficient. So, and Tesla's return on invested capital is like, you know, is basically completely another level. It's like going to the Apple level where the other guys are stuck at like the 10% level. So it has just shown that Tesla is not just a clever hardware software manufacturing company. It's actually a great manufacturing company too. So I think that's one. The other thing is, the other myth that has been going around is, oh, well, you know, you stick a battery in and, you know, it works. Well, look at what happened to the Chevy Volt. Bolt.
Hey, every one of them is being, as long as you don't park within 50 feet of another car, you're totally fine. And that's not a problem here. As you know, here in cities in the US, we have nothing but space available for parking.
Well, I guess you just don't park it in your garage. That's probably okay. Just park it in your neighbor's garage, a neighbor you don't like.
There's no place within 30 miles of my house where you could get a 50-foot clearance for parking.
So I mean, that's the other myth, right? You know, it's not that simple. If it was just a question of taking the chassis and removing, you know, just putting a battery in, well, the Bolt is showing, or the Nissan, or the Ford Mach-E, it's showed a grand total of 18,000 vehicles year to date. They're just not enough traction because I think they're still very compliance oriented, which is basically making the same thing as an ICE age vehicle, just, you know, trying to put a battery in it. That's part of the, I think, the problem. Can they survive, right? And that's a great question. The company that I admire most as for vehicles would be Toyota. And I think that's the company that's dragging its feet the most. It has been talking hydrogen, and hybrids, and not done. It's actually done the least amount of work to get to EV, which is, like, very, very strange for a company, you know, like Toyota. And I just don't know what to say about that. You know, Volkswagen, I think, is the company that I would say is ahead in the game. It really thinks that if it doesn't do electric vehicles, it will not exist. So Volkswagen, I think, is doing the right thing among the big guys. But gosh, Toyota, I don't know. I would be worried.
I think Toyota has maybe put its eggs in the Apple basket, and whether that actually happens or not, is very debatable. Because look, when I bought my Prius, I had no predisposition to other than I knew I was going to buy a hybrid or an electric vehicle used. And I got the Consumer Reports, the annual edition about used cars, and it had like a 3-page article on batteries. And it basically said like, yeah, the Prius battery works forever and it has very little degradation and all the other ones. So it's like, wait, I'm going to spend this money and I'm going to buy a Ford electric vehicle. And it's 6 years from now going to be giving me the same problems a traditional gas engine would get. That to me is a deal breaker. And again, your past experience matters. The fact that, you know, I had a Corolla that my, or as a Camry that my business partner at the time had given me that had like 300,000 miles on it. And I drove it from Connecticut to Florida and kept it in the hot sun and used it once a month when I was here before we lived here permanently. And it worked great. That speaks really well to me about Toyota. And I think that's part of the Tesla loyalty. The manufacturing problems, I'm going to get to another question, a final question in a second. I think the manufacturing issues are a little bit what I've talked about with some of the retail stores as they figure out the balance between self-checkout and auto-checkout and clerks. But they might not get that balance right for a while. Like you walk into a lot of places, you're like, wait, they're hurting me towards self-checkout, but there's only four of them and it doesn't work that well. And I'm buying wine and someone's going to need to sign that in anyway, or I'm buying masks, which are tax-free and that requires a person. So like, those are the little glitches that I think are just operational that you have to overlook. And sure, if I bought a Tesla and something was not right in it and it took me 6 months to get it repaired, like that would be a niche. But let me ask as a last question here before we seg to Rivian. We're going to do one little thing before that. Before we fully seg to Rivian, it's if you had to worry about something, what would you worry about when it comes to Tesla? What could go wrong? Because we always like to say we love these companies, but there is a bear case. You know, for Chipotle, remember when it was, oh my God, what if they run out of avocados, as if you're not going to go get Chipotle just because there's no guacamole. But what is the guacamole scenario for Tesla?
Yeah, so the guacamole scenario, I think for Tesla right now is, I think the product roadmap is fine. The manufacturing roadmap is fine. I think the demand roadmap is fine. Those are not the problems. The customer fanfare is also fine, right? I think actually the biggest problem is that they have their dependency on one man. Externally is huge, right? Now, of course, that's one person. Elon Musk didn't actually, you know, while he might have single-handedly play a huge role in the company, we need to understand that there are many other people in the company that play important roles and that, you know, he brings in talent and things like that. What is right now missing though is just this bench strength. Now, even during the Steve Jobs, and I'm just bringing an Apple analogy because it's useful because, you know, again, larger than life figure, Steve Jobs, he always had number of number twos, like a huge slate of number twos, whether it's, you know, the Phil Schillers or Craig Federighi or, you know, Johnny Ive. There were a number of huge big ticket people around Steve, around Jobs. I think that's sort of missing to some extent. You know, Tesla has done that a few times with various, you know, battery day and autonomy day where they've showcased a number of people. But what they've showcased though is that they've shown technical people. They've shown that these technical people are super smart and they are really like ahead of the game. What you want is not just a technical person. You want a technical person who is also, you don't need somebody who's super technical. You need somebody who understands at a high level the techniques and the technicality. But it's also a good marketer, is a good presenter, is a good showman, right? And that's kind of sort of missing right now at Tesla. I think that's Tesla's biggest weakness.
So if Elon Musk dies in a rocket race next month, because there's lots of ways Elon Musk could die. He does not, he's not always the safest behavior. But yes. Like, and I know this is going to sound like a ridiculous name to throw out there, but couldn't they just bring in a really good operator like a John Legere or, you know, or one of the 20 different number twos at Microsoft who we've seen, you know, present? And can't you just have someone who's like really good at operations and find the right people below them? Does it have to be a CEO who like every decision is coming from?
I don't think Tesla is at that position yet. Tesla doesn't have like an Apple, like an ecosystem, right? And Tesla doesn't have yet, I think it's just too young a company at this point, and it's still very early in that S-curve Right. So I think the Elon Musk single person risk is still very high. That'll dissipate maybe in the next 5 years, and next 5 years probably become clearer who are these people that are there. Now, to this point, though, we tend to think, and maybe this is more relevant because this is a consumer discretionary consumer products company, right? This doesn't matter that much if you're an enterprise company. Like, so it didn't matter for Microsoft that Bill Gates left, and then we had Steve Ballmer, and then, nobody knew Satya Nadella, really, right? And it doesn't matter.
No, it was a shocking pick, and I worked shocking there, pick. Right around that time.
Yeah. It's who's Satya Nadella, right? And the same thing with Sundar Pichai, right? So it doesn't matter for enterprise or business focused, business to business companies. It does matter for business to business, consumer facing businesses, who the person is, who the leader is, right? So I think that in my mind is, and of course, as you said, Elon Musk is not the least risky type of individual, right? He could decide that I'm going to go to space or something, or, build a space module and go and live there for some time.
He could challenge Bezos to a duel. Like, there are definitely some risks involved here. And the reason I threw out John Legere is because there aren't that many larger than life CEOs right now that would certainly be available and in the market. But yeah, look, Tim Cook is the right CEO for Apple now. I'm not sure he would have been the right CEO. And I'm not sure in a few years as we pivot into whatever is next, because I don't think the iPhone is forever a dominant product. At some point, there's going to be head holograms or whatever new technology it is. I'm not sure he's the guy at that point. That's the challenge that any company has, is sort of figuring it out. I'm not a big fan of like the Disney like mandatory retirement age issues, but would you be happier if Bob Iger was in charge or Bob Chapek? The answer is Bob Iger. So it's like
Bob Iger. Yeah.
Yeah. This is really tricky. So Elon Musk, we're going to be sending you some bubble wrap and maybe a helmet. Be a little bit more careful. Before we talk about Rivian, we are going to talk about something that Anirban has done. He has written what we call a special free report. That is an SFR in industry speak, the dumbest name of anything. But what does this mean? This is a report, an in-depth report. And what is this covering? Well, the topic here is zero trust the cybersecurity framework for the 21st century? What does that mean, Anirban, in 30 seconds?
Well, so cybersecurity overall is changing big time. And it's changing big time because of the way we are interacting with IT these days. So there's cloud computing. We no longer have all of our IT infrastructure for your company housed in one location. We don't have it sitting in this room, which is, being air cooled, like the good old days. So a lot of the things that we used to do for IT security no longer work. And that's why we have a new paradigm shift where, in that paradigm shift, we have zero trust emerging sort of as the leader. And zero trust effectively means that you don't by default trust anyone. So you want to look at the connections, you want to look at the traffic flow to decide whether or not, and you look at patterns of access to decide whether or not you want to trust someone. So this report basically looks into how the IT landscape has changed and why that necessitates a change in how people think about security. It talks a bit about all the big, security scares we have had, or the cyber crimes we have had of late. And then it goes into talking about what zero trust means. Zero trust is an idea. And what are the various components of zero trust and how do you enable it? Again, I think this is a big area. So I'd encourage people to read it. It's a special free report. If you give us your email, you get access to it for free. And it's got a few ideas that I put out that I think are, you can call it a basket of ideas that you can use to build a cybersecurity type of piece, if you will. I enjoyed writing it up.
If you would like this report, you go to our homepage, you go to 7investing.com. This assumes if you're a member, you have access to this anyway. If you're not a member, you go to the homepage, you click on the link that says get free report, you enter your email and your name, and we will send you the report. We are really excited about this. We're going to be doing more of these. We're going to be doing more hype around these, more rollouts, more videos, more all sorts of exciting stuff. But this is a really, really good one. And the one we have coming next after this is exciting as well. So please get your email. We promise we won't annoy you. We don't send a ton of annoying email. We are We are very, very careful in how we do that. But we're going to talk next about Rivian. That is an electric vehicle company. It's backed by Amazon, and they've filed for an IPO. Anirban, what's the 10,000-foot overview of Rivian, a company that I am shocked to learn is worth as much as it's worth?
Oh, wow. So, yeah, you didn't say how much should I reveal.
That's I'm leaving it to you. Yeah.
So apparently, well, this was what was published in Bloomberg and what I read on Bloomberg and what I think you pointed me to in Bloomberg, which apparently it's going to looking to list on the market, the market capitalization of around $80 billion. $80 billion. This company hasn't yet produced a vehicle, or that just maybe produced some, let's call it better than prototype vehicles. So they are basically a truck, or I don't know, pickup truck manufacturer. They're also looking to produce a van. So they're not directly competing, let's say, with Tesla, but they're competing in one of what I would say the most lucrative market in the US is, which is the pickup truck market. I believe like some of the top, I think the top five vehicles that are sold in the US, or I think in North America overall, happen to be either pickup trucks or suburban utility or utility vehicles or SUVs. So this is a very lucrative market, and yeah, so they're a pure EV company, so they're not a ice age company trying to make EVs. They are a pure EV company, just like the other EV company, Lucid, which makes luxury sedans.
There is a Lucid office or sales room down the street from me that used to be a pizza place, but it has been very nicely transformed. It's not quite open yet, but it looks really, really pretty. So they lost about $1 billion in the first half of the year. In the world of electric vehicles, that's like me saying like Anirban lost a couple of t-shirts that he likes. Like it is not a significant amount of money, but based on what they're saying, they're looking at about an $80 billion valuation. That is a massive valuation, is it not?
It is. But I mean, the market is, so I think my understanding is that they're looking to sell the trucks approximately priced around that 60-70K sort of area with a 300 sort of mile range. That's the juicy market, right? That's the Ford 150 market. And Ford is making the Ford Lightning, right? So, I mean, that's again, a huge area. What I think is interesting here is I think their go-to-market strategy is something which I think is very interesting. And I think this is interesting because they are going for mass market. This is mass market, right? The Ford 150 is mass market. And going for mass market typically means taking a slightly lower margins, typically means production at scale. What I find interesting is that unlike, say, Lucid or Tesla, so Tesla basically made the Roadster, then made the Model S, then made the Model 3, then made the Model Y. In fact, it didn't make the Model Y first. It made the Model 3 before it made the Model Y. So it's progressively gone from producing niche vehicles to larger and larger vehicles. These guys want to go all out to produce the truck. And Tesla has not yet gone to the truck. It has unveiled a truck, but it hasn't, you know, the monstrosity called the Cybertruck, as some people call it. I have a feeling it's going to be probably the biggest hit in Tesla's career of making devices or making vehicles. But that's what these guys have chosen. So I think it's a very high risk strategy where the potential for upside is huge, just because they're going to be one of the first ones to be out of the gate in terms of one of the first ones maybe butting heads with the Ford Ford Lightning, whatever it is called, but they might also land up with the Tesla's Model 3, like, you know, sales ramp issues. The other thing I want to say is, you said losing money in electric vehicle market is not a big deal, but here's the thing. Tesla did not lose $1 billion until it actually started producing the Model 3. I think Tesla's biggest net income, on the net income line at least, loss was about close to $2 billion in 2017. So, I don't know what we want to say. This is, again, very high-risk strategy.
Let me ask the question. We'll get to the Amazon piece of this in a second, but I have a pretty deep history with pickup trucks. I live in a land where a lot of people drive pickup trucks that don't have any logical reason to drive them. My family makes a line of pickup truck racks, which is one of our more successful products, which I sold. So those are people who are actually using their pickup trucks. But that being said, are we sure that people want an electric pickup truck? Is that definitely a thing?
Well, I don't know. Like, I have a Cybertruck order. I am definitely not of the, I've never had a pickup truck, but I might actually really get a Cybertruck just because it looks cool. So do people need electric? Well, people, we know for a fact that pickup trucks sell, right? And that there are two types of customers for pickup truck, right? Those who need it because they have to carry things, and those who don't need it but have it because it's kind of cool to drive this hunking big thing. So I think the market is there. The issue really for Rivian would be, can they actually attack that market? Can they get enough market share? And can they scale quickly in a profit? I mean, if you're already losing $1 billion and you still have to produce, you haven't yet really produced anything, I think you're going to lose several more billion before you get there. Are they going to get enough scale? Are they going to be able to do it at volume and still have good margin on it and compete with the Ford 150 or F-150? That's going to be hard. And the final thing is, I think for the people who need an electric truck for work, I'm not really sure if 300 miles is enough range, or because you would need, potentially you'd be driving all day. Potentially you want to actually have power supply from it. You potentially need a charging network. You know, we could say that there is a third party charging networks coming up. Are they yet there already in terms of infrastructure? I don't think so. And one of the biggest assets Tesla has got right now in its favor is basically supercharging network, right? So Teslas can use supercharging network of its own plus all the others that are available. Well, the others can't. So there's a serious disadvantage.
Yeah, I'll speak anecdotally and say if it's a 300-mile range, pickup trucks tend to be used for local deliveries, contractors doing jobs. I don't know that 300 miles wouldn't be enough. But there is the mental factor of, wait, there's no place around to charge. And I do think that's a factor for a few years. I'm not sure it will be, because if this does become the norm, and pickup trucks are obviously very, very common in the construction space, I think you might see like Porta chargers or other things just become de facto on big job sites and other places. I mean, we're seeing them. I've told you there is a Tesla charger and an alternate charger at my resort place. The Tesla charger charges Teslas. The alt one, I've never seen it charge anything other than a golf cart, but in theory, it can charge other electric vehicles. But I do think Florida as a tourist state might be ahead of a lot of other states in terms of building out charger networks.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's an interesting strategy. And the other thing with Rivian is Rivian was big backers, right? It's got some traditional, I forgot who the traditional auto is. There is either Ford or GM is involved. One of them is involved. There's Amazon is, of course, involved. Amazon also has a deal with them, right, to buy X thousand of these delivery trucks or delivery or vans from them and things like that. So it's, I guess the last thing I want to point out is, if $80 billion is the valuation, then I guess we need to, yes, the electric vehicle market has been now proven to exist as a real market by Tesla. So I understand that they deserve a higher valuation, but $80 billion sounds a tad high. Because if 10 years ago, Tesla went public at, I think, less than $3 billion market cap, right? Inflation is not that big in 10 years, and the market has not been established to that extent. Tesla is still not producing a million. Tesla's probably just at a million vehicle run rate at this point. $80 billion sounds a heck of a lot. There's a lot of, anticipation baked into that $80 billion, right? I mean,
well, let's close out with this. Well, we need to talk about the Amazon piece first. So we'll get to the final thoughts, but so Amazon has the rights for 4 years to buy every delivery vehicle Rivian makes. Assuming Amazon likes how these delivery vehicles are, the only reason they don't have to do it, right, is to give them an out in case these, turn out not the way they expect them to. This is likely going to be a company buoying deal. Is this fair to say?
Yeah, so if there is no, Amazon buying pickup? Is it Amazon's going to buy the vans, right? Not really that. Is Amazon buying the truck?
Yeah, they just said delivery vehicle. They haven't been particularly clear, but that's clearly not the pickup truck. So it's likely
it's not the pickup truck, unless they're going to take the pickup truck and actually modify it and put, you know, a storage space on it, which actually sound terribly inefficient way of doing it. Look, I mean, I think it's neither here. Like, that's just a guaranteed customer, but I mean, how many of them is Amazon going to really buy? And maybe it makes sense. Okay, so here's the thing, right? Maybe it makes sense for Amazon, because if you are Amazon, you could actually put your own chargers in your various warehouses and various points you need to do. It will work for Amazon. It is not going to work for the common person, right? And therefore, does that give you scale? Right. It's I think those sort of things. So it's good to have a marquee client, and it's good to have some guaranteed sales. And it's not like guaranteed sales. They have to like it, right? So it's not like they're saying, we'll buy whatever you make. We'll buy it if we like it and if we still need it.
Yeah, it's 100,000 vehicles by 2030, assuming they like it. They don't actually have to buy one, but yeah. I do think they intend to. There are Tesla chargers at most Whole Foods. That's not an Amazon strategy. I think that's actually more a whoever owns the land where Whole Foods are on strategy. Yeah. But that's a good point, that when you have a big footprint, I don't know if you've seen an Amazon distribution center, but it basically looks like a college campus where you'd spend your whole time lost because every building is one giant building that looks the same. Lots of places there you could put in a charging station or multiple charging stations.
Yeah. So for commercial folks, I think electric vehicles, electric vans and electric pickups and all those sort of things, electric buses and all those would make a ton of sense, because they would pretty much control, you know, satellite campus A to satellite campus B, satellite location A to satellite location B. That's sort of the travel. You're going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. I think it works really well in that context. And overall, maybe the cost of ownership is low. There is nothing else really that competes with Rivian at this point. Amazon really doesn't have an alternative to compare against. The question is, it's by 2030, right? A lot of things can change between now and, you know, that's like 8 years. So that's a long, long, you know, and a lot of things will change if we have autonomous. We didn't talk about autonomy, but if there's autonomy, a lot of things will change in that 8 year timeframe. So I just think, yeah, that's, you know, it's neither here nor there for me.
I still want a land speeder or a hover car. Like, it feels to me like I should have been driving at least the one Luke had in the first Star Wars by now, but we don't have that. Let me ask the last question here. So there is a chance for big success here. I can see what the market is, but they're coming up against Tesla. And look, I don't love the Cybertruck. It is not designed for work. And that is a concern to me with the truck. The sides are very low. It's not particularly practical. So if that's an artist rendering, it doesn't look like that. But that being said, they're coming up against Tesla. They're coming up against Ford. There is a lot of upside here, as this is a huge market. But there's also a chance for zero, right? Like, this could be an absolute epic disaster. This is a very risky investment, right?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, one way to think about this is, well, if Ford, if their pickup truck looks very similar to the Ford Lightning. It's actually not a radical design in that sense. It looks like a traditional, the Rivian looks like a traditional design. So if Rivian is going to be successful, maybe Ford is going to be successful. The Ford's market cap is $50 billion or something like that. I haven't even looked at it, but I'm guessing it's somewhere in that ballpark. If you're going to go to $80 billion, I don't know. There is a lot of success baked into that valuation. Like, you know, it means that you're going to be doing more than trucks, and you're going to be doing a lot more other things. You're going to have very high margins. So I don't know. And you're losing, and it is. There is no guarantee that your production ramp up, you know, it's as the Elon Musk line, is very easy to make concept vehicles, very easy to make prototypes. It is really, really hard to scale manufacturing, right? And to do it at scale, at, you know, with return on invested capital, all of those good things, right? I don't know. Like, I mean, it's something, I think it's very interesting, but the upside here seems low to me. The upside all here is at $80 billion, all the people who have gotten in before they go public are the ones who are actually going to make a lot of money here, right?
Investors be very wary. To justify an $80 billion valuation, you need a lot of sales and you need them quickly. Now, that doesn't mean the ride won't get there, but it might mean that there are points where this looks like not great. So be very, very careful. I always say with IPOs, if it's going to be a great company, it's not that important to get in on day one, especially when it's a company at this time. This isn't some really cool company that's coming out at a $1.2 billion market cap or a $6 billion market cap. This is assuming the truck works. They've made and sold no trucks. They have sold exactly as many trucks, in fact, as Anirban and I have sold. Our valuation is hovering around $20 billion. No, sadly, it's not. With that, we're going to close this out. We've gone longer than I expected to go. If you'd like to get in touch with us, that is info@7investing.com. Apologies that there's no graphic popping up, but we're taping this in a different format than we usually do the live show in. If you would like to interact with us on Twitter, we are @7investing on Twitter. For Anirban Mahanty, thank you to JT Street, who is airing this live. Thank you to all of you who watched. Feel free to send in your questions through @7investing or to either of us personally. We would love to answer. I'm sure we will revisit this IPO and these topics again. We will see you on Friday.
A reminder that people on this program may hold positions in the companies that are mentioned. Buying and selling stock carries financial risk, which could include the loss of capital. The views in this program should not be taken as personalized advice. Before acting on any of the information provided, listeners are encouraged to consult a financial or tax professional.